Tonight on Arena, Pat Collins on his film adaptation of John McGahern's That They May Face the Rising Sun, and we review Salman Rushdie's new book, Knife. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. John McGahern's final novel, That They May Face the Rising Sun, is about 1 year in the life of a lakeside community in County Leitrim. The rhythms of the land are sacrosanct, and through the everyday rituals of work, reflection and conversation, a portrait of a rural Ireland emerges. A feature film adaptation of That They May Face the Rising Sun from director Pat Collins will be released this Friday in cinemas. In fact, it has just won Best Film at the IFTAs on Saturday night. It stars Barry Ward as Joe Rutledge, a local man who has moved home from London to Leitrim to write and live with his German artist wife, Kate. Through their eyes, we see a community of characters played by actors like Sean McGinley, Laura Ruddy, John Olhan, Ruth McCabe and Brendan Connery. Delighted to be joined by co-writer and director of That They May Face the Rising Sun, Pat Collins, who is in our Cork studio this evening. You have a track record with McGahern in that you had made the documentary McGahern, A Private World in 2005. What brought you to this particular novel as a feature film, Pat?
I think it was my favourite of all of John's novels. I think it was along with his collected short stories, I think there were the two books that I was most drawn to. And I think it's just the material out of which the Rising Sun is made, I think, is time and the seasons and a small community living around the lake. And it was the one, I think, it's quite elegiac in some ways, even though there's a lot of darkness in the book. But it was the one, I suppose, that maybe because I grew up in something similar myself, that I was drawn to it. And I think that nobody else had captured it quite like McGahern had. And I think because of all that complexity and the elegiac quality, I think he had a mix of both. And it wasn't any way kind of unrealistic. It was the characters were very real. And I think everybody who lived in rural Ireland at that time and even maybe still will recognise those characters, I think. And I think they're completely universal anyway. I think those characters are everywhere, really. They're in every townland and they're in every country, but they're just the local detail is just a little different, I think.
Yeah, and we have Joe and Kate, who are Barry Ward and Anna Baderke, who are the artists from outside, if you like, who've come into the community. And then we have a couple played by Philip Nolan and Ruth McCabe, the character of Bill played by Brendan Conroy, and the Shah played by John Olenan. How much are these characters based on actual characters from McGahern's own life, do you think? Particularly the Shah.
Well, I think the Shah was very close to an uncle of his, and we had a screening in Carrick and Shannon last week, and the audience there were just full of stories about the people that the characters were based on. And I think they were kind of inspired by, I suppose, rather than kind of based too closely to reality. But I think the Shah in particular, I mean, in the novel, he's very much a confirmed bachelor. And we do take some liberties with that. We felt he deserved a little happiness. So we marry him off in the film, which some McGahern purists mightn't like. But it's, a film and a book are two different things. But I didn't really go past what was in the novel. I didn't, talk to anybody outside of the novel in the sense of trying to find out who the characters were. Even though, I mean, I was talking to Madeline, John McGahern's wife, last week, and she was saying, for instance, that the character that inspired Patrick.
This is the character played by Laura Ruddy.
Yeah, and she said that it was kind of uncanny, But that's, again, that's Laura going deep, I think, and going deep himself and kind of looking at what was in the novel and what was in the script and
finding more within it.
Exactly.
And Patrick, the Laura Ruddy character, is very friendly with Johnny, the character played by Sean McGinley. That character has gone away to London and has come back. And I want to listen to a clip which, in fact, features several of them. We will hear Sean McGinley's Johnny home from London, and then Patrick, the confirmed bachelor, played by Laura Ruddy. And it's interesting how the person coming home from London has to kind of up the ante a little bit and describe maybe what they're doing there a little in brighter terms, perhaps, than the reality.
Okay.
And you're still in Ford's?
Still there. They have me in the canteen now. Over it in the floors and keeping the toilets clean. Sure. So you'd hardly call it work.
Jesus. I think so many around here were forced out to England and America. You left a cracking job here netting fish to go cleaning English taxes. You made the mistake of your life when you left.
Patrick shows none of us mercy.
I tell the truth and ask no favours.
That might not always be the best approach.
Tell me then what is, lad.
Kindness? Understanding? Sympathy? Tact? Humour, maybe?
Put that out in the yard, lad.
There you go, Laura Ruddy. That's Patrick there, the final voice in that clip from That They May Face the Rising Sun, and co-writer and director of the film, Pat Collins, is in our Cork studio this evening. He can be very sharp, can the character of Patrick. How cruel a character do you think he is, Pat? Or what were you looking for there, and how did Laura go about portraying that, do you think?
Well, I mean, despite the fact that the character of Patrick is, you know, he is cruel and he says cruel things, there's still something very charismatic about him. You kind of feel that he has a certain kind of knowledge about things that you might not know yourself, you know, and that people are very much drawn to him and sympathise with him, even though he's very complex and he's very dark, I think, as well. But I think, you know, again, you know, there was a character, I think, that lived around the lake that used to, he was a tradesman and he used to, himself and the character, I think, that Johnny, the Sean McGinley character, are based on, like, they were very much into the amateur drama. They had, I suppose, artistic temperaments almost, you know, and that they were drawn to acting, they were drawn to literature. One of the characters used to visit them, John and Madeline, and read passages from various novels that they'd read during the week, you know, and I think that's again, I think it's often kind of undervalued the complexity of those people and the intelligence of those people that lived around those areas. But there was also kind of frustration, you know, they had, as Henry Glassy might say about the people in Ballymenone, you know, that, you know, one of the characters that he had there, Hugh Nolan, you know, they were. Had the mind of an Oxford professor, but he had no outlet whatsoever.
Well, it is when they talk about, particularly the Patrick and the Johnny characters, loving drama and loving the various plays. They have real insights into the various plays they talk about. But I wonder to what extent you have Joe Rutledge as a writer here. I think he maybe worked in advertising in the original in the book originally, and then Kate as the artistic wife. To what extent do you think this character, maybe more so than many others, is a true reflection of the late McGahern, you know, the writer McGahern that maybe we've come to know?
Well, I mean, I really didn't want the character of Joe Rutledge to be based on John, really. And I mean, I spoke with Barry Ward, the actor, about that. Is that, you know, in no way try to, you know, impersonate John or try to get his voice in any way similar to John's voice, to find the role himself. And I think it's just that in the book, Joe Rutledge works in advertising. And I just kind of felt, though, that I never fully believed that he was working in advertising. Yeah. And I just kind of thought that it was had much more potential if we make the character a writer. And it would have allowed us then to use some of the beautiful passages from the book directly. And I think that adds a lot to the film, that we can hear what the character, yeah, Joe Rutledge is writing. But I didn't want it either to be driving the narrative, or it's just kind of his reflections on the seasons, on time passing, but not to drive the narrative, because that would have been a kind of a mistake, I think. You know?
Yeah, and the narrative aspect of the film is quite interesting. At one point, the character of Joe, he's writing a novel all along, but he's talking about the novel that he's writing at this moment in time, and he says about the novel, there's not much by way of drama, just day-to-day things, which is quite a challenge when it comes to giving us a film. What did that open up for you in terms of how you presented us with the story of the film here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was what attracted me to the book in lots of ways, in terms of making the film in the first place. I think of all the McGarrahan films or books, I was drawn to that because of the fact that there was no driving narrative. And, you know, that, and that the material was time passing and the seasons and these characters around the lake. So it was, I mean, that allows the filmmaker, I suppose, a lot of scope in terms of kind of trying to portray that community and not to be a slave to story, you know. I mean, a story is important, don't get me wrong. Hmm. But it's just, I think once the narrative takes over, then everything serves that narrative, and I didn't want that. And I thought then that Rising Sun, in a way, was the perfect vehicle for that.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
So in fact, in the opening scene, the very opening scene of the film, I noticed this when I was watching, you know, it is a sun rising. Now, you can't speed that up or hurry that up no matter how you try. And I thought, by giving us that opening scene of the sun slowly rising, you were, in fact, slowing us right down in terms of how we might watch this film.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's important. And I mean, and I kind of joke about this, that the film is better the second time you see it. But once your narrative expectations are gone, I think you actually enjoy it more. And it is, I mean, it's not willfully slow or anything like that. I don't think, you know, it has to be slow. I mean, it would be ludicrous to make a film like this using kind of fast pace and fast cuts. I mean, and that shot of the sunrise, I mean, we walked out after breakfast and shot it in the wintertime, and Richard Kendrick was already shooting, the cameraman. He was shooting the sunrise. And then I walked into the edit one day and Keith Walsh had the sunrise down as the opening shot. And we just kept it at that, you know. Yeah, and it sets it up very well, I think.
Yeah, you know? I wondered, had you gone out to get several sunrises, or was it an accidental happening? And it sounds as if it was more of an accidental happening than anything else, but it is a very strong opening. I've mentioned some of the actors that are involved, you know, household names that everybody knows, Sean McGinley, John Olahan, etc., Barry Ward. But there's one person in the midst of all of this, Philip Nolan. Yeah. Let's have a listen to him in action. This is quite early on in the film, in fact. Philip Dolan, I beg your pardon, is his name. And he plays the kindly neighbour. He plays Jamesy, who visits Joe and Kate on a regular basis. And here's one of their early encounters with each other.
Did you ever notice, as the body gets old and stiff, we stay young in our heads? And you know, it's only when we're old that we see the old are the same as the young.
So how would we know? We're hardly out of short pants.
You can fool yourself, but you're not fooling me.
Cheers, Jamesy.
Cheers, Kate. Good luck, Joe. You were missing from Mass again, and it was noticed.
I'm sure you know we don't believe.
Kate, sure none of us believe.
Why do you go so? I never get that.
Well, me, I go to look at the women, to see the other hypocrites, and to watch the whole performance.
So what's your news?
No news. Came looking for news. The cuckoo's back. That's my news.
That's always good news.
Barry Ward, Anne Bedurka, and Philip Dolan there in a scene from That They May Face the Rising Sun. Pat Collins, co-writer and director, with me on the programme this evening. What was it about Philip? First of all, did you come across him, and what was it about him that made you want to cast him in that role of Jamesy? Vital in the story that you're telling, Pat.
Yeah, I mean, Jamesy was the one character that I found really difficult to cast, and we were, I'd say, maybe 6 months looking around for different actors, and I always had the kind of suspicion that it might have to be a non-actor, and because Jamesy's character is quite unusual, I think he's a kind of the spirit of the book in lots of ways, and Yeah, so we were for a long time we couldn't find anybody, and then I happened to be up in Knockrockery Singing Festival with Thomas McCarthy, the traditional singer, and Thomas knew Philip and he introduced me, and then Philip, he kind of bowed down very graciously in the street, and he said, "Oh, I must bow down to the important man from RTE," and even though I wasn't from RTE, but so it was kind of, it's very much what Jamesy does in the book. He bows down and he kind of almost acts. You know what I mean? That's he's and I we went into the singing festival, and then about 2 hours later, Jamesy, our head Philip, gets up and he tells a couple of stories, and I thought, you know, God, this is very close to Jamesy, really. And then a few months later, I rang him and I said, you know, Philip, have you ever acted before? And he said he hadn't. And I said, would you like to? And he said, I'd love to. And so we brought Maureen Hughes and myself, then went up to meet him again, and we spent a couple of hours with him. And he was really up for the challenge. Mm. You know, he was he's from Cavan, but lives in Knockrockery in Roscommon, and had knew McGarrahan inside out. You know, he'd read the novel a good couple of times before I ever spoke to him about it. So a very well-read man, very, you know, well-travelled man. And yet he kind of embodies something very soulful, I think, about the countryside, I think, you know.
Yeah, and there you're talking about him being from Cavan, and obviously the actors are from various parts of the country. And you shot it in Loch Nafooey, near Loch Nafooey in County Galway. I suppose the location per se wasn't vital to it, but yet it's very specific in terms of it is this set of lanes around that lake and this community.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of slightly controversial that we didn't shoot in Leitrim, I suppose. Mm. And I really wanted to shoot in Leitrim. If he'd said to me 5 years ago that we wouldn't shoot in Leitrim, I wouldn't have believed you. But it's just we looked at every lake in Leitrim, and just, I suppose, maybe even the lake. Finally, I went to the lake that where John lived, and even that had changed so much in the last 18 years. You know, the trees had got taller. You couldn't see the lake from certain houses.
Yeah.
The houses had been modernised, and it was really kind of despairing, really. But we ended up, I think my wife suggested that, she said, what about Loch Nafooey? We'd been there to the Larches maybe 25 years ago of a Patrick's Day. And that's where Joe Hogan, actually, the basket maker, he lives out there, and we knew that. And so the producer, Brendan Byrne, went down the next morning, took photographs, and we just moved
everything. Decided on that.
We decided on that. And we were, and there's actually about five lakes that we filmed, you know, between Lower Loch Mask and Loch Nafooey and Loch Corrib. And we did actually use a
variety of places.
A variety of places. But it was all based around Clonbur. It's a really beautiful place, and Loch Nafooey is a gorgeous place.
I know it's always, no matter, you know, when you're adapting a book for the stage or indeed for the screen, you're always going to have to leave bits of it out. But one thing, that notable missing item here, was John Quinn in the film. He's the womaniser in the book, isn't he? He has sex up the hill with his new bride in view of the wedding party. Any particular reason that you dropped that character?
Well, yeah, I mean, it causes a lot of sleepless nights, I think. I think, you know, at this remove now, I'm very happy with the decision to take John Quinn out, because I think there's enough complexity in some of the characters and enough darkness in Patrick and other areas that I really didn't want the people coming out of the cinema talking about how much of a brute John Quinn was. I think he would have dominated. Especially, you know, it's different in a novel where you have like 300 pages to move away from him and change the tone. But in a film, I think when you see John Quinn up on the big screen in front of you, and he's and a character like that, it's very dominating and domineering, and I just felt there was too much darkness attached to him, and I wanted people to come out, I suppose, talking about the community that lived around the lake, rather than the one terrible character.
Yeah,
and it was. I think if we were losing all of the darkness, I think I wouldn't agree with that myself. But I think there's enough complexity there to allow us to lose John Quinn. I mean, I'm very happy with the decision now, really. And I think, strangely enough, I think a lot of people have come up to me afterwards and said, I'm delighted that John Quinn isn't in it.
Yeah. There you go. I want to listen to a clip from the 2005 documentary that I mentioned, your own documentary, John McGahern, A Private World. This is McGahern himself talking about writing and the role of the writer.
I don't think the novel is completed by the writer, that it's completed by the reader. And I think in that sense that all good writing is suggestion, and that nearly all bad writing is statement. Well, of course, the writer is present in the work because personality, which is called style in writing, is the most important thing in any work. But I like Flaubert's definition of how that should be done, where he says that the writer should be present everywhere, but nowhere visible, like God in nature.
That's John McGahern from the documentary John McGahern, A Private World, Pat Collins' film from 2005. Pat is with me on the programme this evening talking about a feature film has just been released, adapted from McGahern's final novel, That They May Face the Rising Sun. Good advice that for the writer. It's good advice for a filmmaker, lots within that as well, I would think, Pat.
Well, I suppose it depends on what you're trying to do. I mean, I wouldn't, I wouldn't give it as advice to every filmmaker. But if you're trying to work with, I think a lot of what I try to do with film, in some ways, is kind of almost try to get out of the way. In some ways, you know, that you're, I think, if you're too controlling and you're too driven by the narrative and the story, that there's no room for anything else. And I do like the idea that of a kind of the space for someone to bring themselves to it. I think it's very common, I think, you know, in certain types of filmmakers and certain types of writers. And it's just, I'm not gone on the whole idea of just passively sitting down in a cinema and wanting to be entertained. I think it's a kind of a, I just don't want that in the films that I watch myself and that I enjoy. I prefer a film that changes every time you see it, in a way, because you change as well, you know. And but it's a risky kind of venture, because it's you know, people who are funding and people sometimes, you know, writing reviews and the rest, they want certainty, you know. And yeah. But I think it's much better to be in that, you know, uncertain place where you're finding something. And you're finding the natural pace for something, and you're finding the natural story, and that I think people, you know, can bring part of themselves to it. I mean, I think it's common. Say, Abbas Kiarostami had the same idea of a half-made film. You know, that the viewer brings themselves and completes the story, you know. Mm. And John had that as well himself with his own novels.
Funny, Paul Muldoon was on with us last night, the poet, and he was talking about exactly the same thing when writing a poem, about getting out of the way to let the poem write itself in some ways. I suppose, yeah. McGahern mentions in that clip I just played about God and nature. Nature is a very important character in this film in particular, because we see the seasons, we see the year progress from the lush greenness of the summertime into the bleak, snowy winter, and then back again into the hope of new spring.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of an important part of a lot of what I do in terms of film, but I think it's obviously very, like John described nature beautifully, but I don't think the community around the lake felt themselves separate to it in the same way that maybe people do now. You know, people were very much, you know, that Seamus Heaney phrase about, you know, that we lived a kind of creaturely existence, you know, that it's in such close proximity to animals and small farms and nature and the seasons passing. You don't really see yourself as being that separate to it. And whereas sometimes nature now can be very much seen as separate. It's something there, it's almost like a commodity or something that you get a dose of every weekend or every long bank holiday weekend or something.
Finally, Pat, you mentioned Thomas McCarthy earlier on there, and you've Songlines, your documentary about Thomas, one of Ireland's best known traveller singers, of course, going out on RTE1 television on Thursday of next week. Give That's us a right. brief line about that film, if you would.
Well, I mean, 2 years ago, before I made Rising Sun, I did a kind of a portrait with Thomas McCarthy about his life and his story, you know, growing up in Ireland and living in London. And when we finished that, he was doing work with ITMA, going around recording different traveller singers around Ireland. So after Rising Sun was filmed, I just kind of asked Thomas if we could go along with him. And Thomas brought us around and we recorded some great traveller singers around the country and heard about people who had been recorded before and people who were, you know, is like Rosie McCarthy from Macroom, who's only 16 and she's a really terrific singer. And then there's like Kitty Cassidy, who's a little bit older, but she was recorded as well when she was a very young woman, and she's still a fantastic singer. So we met, you know, it's brilliant to have somebody like Thomas as our guide, really, and bringing us into homes and people's homes and introducing us to these songs. I mean, a lot of the songs that are in the folk repertoire, like, have been kept alive by travellers, you know. And I think most of the, like, especially the young singers now, they always acknowledge that. But I think there mightn't be there mightn't be an appreciation for it in the wider culture, you know. But there's still some great singers out there. But they don't go looking for attention. Sometimes you have to persuade them to sing. And and I think we actually only, you know, it was the tip of the iceberg, really, I think, you know.
Thanks for speaking with us this evening, Pat.
Thanks very much, Sean.
That's Pat Collins, co-writer and director of the film That They May Face the Rising Sun, which opens in cinemas this Friday. We'll be reviewing it, in fact, on Thursday's Arena. And Pat's documentary Songlines that you just heard about there on the work of Thomas McCarthy will be broadcast on RTÉ1 television at 10:15 p.m. on Thursday of next week, the 2nd of May. Two exciting young artists currently taking the classical world rather by storm are trumpeter Matilda Lloyd and classical guitarist Alexander Whittingham. Music Network have brought them together, and all this week they are touring Ireland. They've already visited Belfast, Letterkenny and Clifton. Tomorrow they will play the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary, Waterford Music Hall after that, Cultura in Cork before their final concert in Waterville in Kerry. Delighted that both of them are in studio this evening with me with their instruments in front of them, and they're going to start off by playing me a little bit of the music of Jacques Bear, some incidental music to a Spanish play. This is an entr'acte. The music of Jackie Bear there, and incidental music to a Spanish play, and that's one of the entr'actes from that. Matilda Lloyd on trumpet, Alexander Whittingham on guitar. Now, you put a mute into the trumpet for that particular piece, Matilda. Did you do that for me and for radio, or does Jackie Bear make you do it?
No, so this piece was actually written originally for flute or violin.
All right.
And with the balance of the instruments as well, with the trumpet and with the guitar, we thought it'd be fun to add that straight mute there. Mm. Also to give it a little bit more of a bite and a bit more sort of a grit in the sound.
Maybe
well.
Just for the sake of the listener, you might give us a few notes without the mute. Now let us hear the same thing with the mute, so that people can hear how kind. In fact, I know now who you're being kind to. So at what point, Alexander Whittingham, did you say, put your mute into that trumpet so that they'll hear my guitar, please?
Yeah, I'm quite lucky. I get amplification during this tour, which is quite good because we don't often get to play with amplification.
Because that was the first thing that struck me when I heard that it was a guitar and a trumpet coming in. I mean, they are two very unusual instruments put together purely because of the very soft nature in some ways of the guitar and the slightly louder nature of the trumpet.
Absolutely, but I think the trumpet is such a versatile instrument, and as you'll hear a bit later on, like, it can really sing and be so beautifully expressive in the same way that the guitar can. Mm. And so I think actually it's a really nice mixture together, a really nice combination of instruments, because we can both be a bit spiky and funky, but then also lyrical and expressive as well.
And it did strike me that even though Hébert is a French composer, that's a very Spanish sounding piece, but that often the French composers seem to have this absolute obsession with Spanish music. Spanish music and the guitar kind of go together hand in hand, really, yeah. Don't they, Alexandra?
Mm. Yeah, I've spent a lot of time playing Spanish music, being a guitarist, because it's one of those things, if anybody ever asks, oh, you play the guitar, what, you know, play me something, you have to play something Spanish, because it's, you know.
And did you start off on, you know, the classical guitar, or did you have hopes to be the rock chick with an electric guitar at one point along your way,
My dream was to be Avril Lavigne, basically, when I was younger. So I very much wanted to do rock and sort of just, yeah, I just wanted to be a rock star, basically, when I was younger. And it was actually, I was probably about 9, 10, and I was having like rock guitar lessons, and I walked into my guitar lesson, and my guitar tutor at the time was playing, I think it was sort of like a Spanish fandango that he was playing.
Yeah, right.
And instantly I was just sort of like, that's what I want to do.
I'll do that instead.
Yeah.
Avril Lavigne can do her thing, I'll do my thing.
Still love Avril Lavigne, I won't
lie.
Yeah,
okay. you obviously not surprising then that we have a number of Spanish, well, certainly two Spanish composers at the end of the programme for the tour that you're doing with Music Network. I see Francisco Torrega is there with the Recuerdos de la Alhambra. Everybody kind of knows that piece.
Yeah.
Would you just give us the first couple of bars so the people know this?
Yeah, it's like the tremolo.
Everybody knows that, I think. Yeah. Knows it. And everybody who have plays the guitar has tried to do that and probably failed at some point along the way. However, you are very adamant about another piece of Torrega's music that you are very keen that everybody hears because of a certain couple of bars towards the end of it.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Did you start this on social media?
Yes, and regretted it instantly. Yeah.
Because every time you go into a radio studio, they say, play us that bit of Torrega that...
Yeah, that I haven't played in months, but yeah. I can give it a go.
Yeah,
see if
give
people
us a,
recognize
cause
it.
Because it's the little bit at the end that we have to listen out
yes.
for.
Yes. Yeah.
Which of you has your phone on in studio?
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. That piece was written when? Back in the 1900s?
The 1800s. Yeah. Yeah.
And Nokia, somebody in Nokia heard that, obviously, for the 3310.
Yeah, very lucrative for them.
That's amazing that you did say to me it's slightly different in the piece in that there's a slightly different note.
Yeah, instead of you have, and then it carries on.
Yeah, so you just that little harmonic note at the end, which is a slightly different
feature. Which I did get told off for on TikTok because many people like to...
That's not the final note.
Yeah, they were like, no, you did that wrong. And I was like, well, no, because I wanted to do the actual ringtone. But yeah, you always get people like that, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. So you either have the classical purists telling you that's not the right note in the piece,
yep.
Or you have the Nokia people who are mad for their TikTok video saying, no, that's not the ringtone. Yeah. The ringtone doesn't end like that.
You'll never please everyone.
So you mentioned along the way there, Matilda, about the facility of the instrument, the trumpet, to sing. Not necessarily what the singer I'd want singing into my ear. Do you have to soften things down? Do you have to make it much more gentle to get that quality from the instrument?
No, I don't think so. So for me, I think the trumpet is probably the most similar instrument to the human voice because it's actually our human flesh. It's our lips that vibrate to make the sound in the same way that the vocal cords vibrate for the singers. And the way we use our tongue to articulate is very similar to the diction in words. And you know, we have to be relaxed and we use our whole bodies and our chests and everything has to be super relaxed and like our body has to really like vibrate to make that sound.
And it also strikes me that the breath is so close. I wonder when you're playing a wind instrument, there's always something about that is closer to singing inevitably because you have to breathe to get the note out of the instrument itself. But you played cello at one point as well.
I did. I played the piano as well when I was younger and the cello, which I think was brilliant. You know, it's given me a real perspective on string instruments, percussion, piano. You know, it's been fabulous to play so many instruments in my childhood, but the trumpet really sort of emerged as the favorite once I started playing in orchestras and made lots of friends.
And I suppose there's so many, it has so many possibilities. The guitar is a very versatile instrument as well, it has to be said too. Alexander, you are going to finish up for me with a song. It is a Benjamin Britten song. Maybe tell me a little bit about this before we hear it.
Yes, it's one of his folk songs and it's called Master Kilby.
And we'll get that lovely singing quality with or without mute this time.
Without.
Without mute. Oh, so there we go. Up to you now. Hope you can keep up to
I'll
the noise.
Loud
and louder on this one, Alexandra. You know, I feel like I'm listening to an English brass band when I hear that. Master Kilby, the music of Benjamin Britten, played for us there. Matilda Lloyd on trumpet, Alexander Whittingham on guitar. Hardly surprising that you should have an album of opera arias on trumpet, Casta Diva, the title of that, and your own album as well. We should mention, Alexander, in the interests of fairness, is called My European Journey,
which
I guess is European guitar tunes from around different countries.
Absolutely, you nailed it. Yeah,
got in one. Thank you so much for coming in and for playing for me this evening. And you can hear Alexandra and Matilda on their tour. They're touring Ireland with Music Network. It continues tomorrow at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary. They're off then to the Waterford Music Hall on Thursday. Friday, they're at Cultúrtha in Cork before their final concert in Waterville in Kerry on Saturday. Full details of all of those venues and times can be found on musicnetwork.ie. .27 seconds was all it took to change Salman Rushdie's life on a sunny Friday morning of 12th of August 2022. The author had just arrived on stage at Chautauqua Institution in upstate New York to talk about, believe it or not, the importance of keeping writers safe from harm. a young man rushed up and stabbed him 15 times. Rushdie was lucky to survive the attack, and he lives now, as he says himself, with, quote, one eye and one and a half hands. His new memoir, Knife, is his account of that day and of his recovery, an uphill battle given the injuries he sustained. Paula Shields has been reading it for us. She joins me now in the studio. I can still remember that day when that news broke. It was the afternoon, about 5 p.m. around at that time, I think, here in Ireland, when the news broke. And, you know, the big question was, is he going to actually survive? That's what was on all of our minds, Paula.
Yes, it was very weird limbo. I imagine a lot of people will remember those moments. It was shocking news to begin with, that someone who'd been survived a death threat from 1989, the fatwa from Ayatollah Khomeini, would then be stabbed in this place we'd never heard of, upstate New York. And there really was a strange kind of limbo when we were waiting to hear, you know, was he got? Yes, we knew he'd gone to hospital, but we didn't know any more than that. And yeah, we knew it was serious.
And, you know, in some ways, there had been the fatwa that had been pronounced on Rushdie back in the day, but that seemed to have gone. But I suppose you should think about the people around him who did suffer at the hands of that, or certainly it seems linked to that fatwa.
Yeah, I mean, there was a Japanese translator who was stabbed in 91.
Of the Satanic Verses.
And there was an Italian translator who survived in a stabbing attempt, and a Norwegian publisher who was shot and survived. So, you know, they were serious times, and he lived, you know, going from safe house to safe house under police protection for 10 years before in 99 feeling it was time to come out and, you know, come out of hiding, and that the threat seemed to have died back, and hence the move to New York and a different kind of freedom there.
And I remember interviewing him here in Ireland, I think after the fatwa had been lifted, and there was a sense that he was felt a little bit easier and safer, but still this kind of overhanging threat there all the time.
Well, he really has lived a life like no other famous author. You know, it was a heck of a death threat. Mm. And Khomeini died in 89, the same year that he issued the decree. And but that didn't lessen the threat at the time. But you imagine that someone like that must always have some kind of shadow in the back of their mind. But he had managed, you know, New York affords privacy. That's the brilliance about big cities. And he loves big cities. He describes himself as a big city boy. And, you know, he'd been there all this time since the year 2000, I think he moved, and able to go about his business. And as he said, he had to go about and look fearless for people to calm down and even have them anywhere near him. Such was, you know, people's worries and associating with him.
So he says of the book Knife, he, again, a quotation, would much rather not to have needed to write. So what is he talking about here? What part of the period in and around this terrible attack is he dealing with?
He is talking about the first year after the attack. And I'm smiling because he tells in the book how Andrew Wiley, his agent, whose nickname is the Jackal, you know, he's got a very high profile client list, said to him in the very early days, "You'll write about this." And Rushdie said, "Of course, no, I won't." And couldn't think about writing until about 3 months after the event. And he had another novel in his mind. And then he realised that he had to write about this to get past, you know, to get on to fiction, to go back to fiction again, I suppose. But really, what he manages to do is write a book of recovery, as well as he, you know, it's dark, but it's got his humour. He talks a lot about love, about his new wife, Eliza Griffiths, about his sons, about the medical staff who saved him.
Extraordinary, his new wife, Eliza Griffiths, they got married. I think he met her in, it was just, it's 2017, was it? Five years before the attack. But they were they even married a year when the attack took place?
No, they've been married September 2021, and the attack took place 11 months later.
Yeah, so just under a year at that point. Knife is quite a strong title, though, isn't it?
Yeah, he's really not messing around. And, you know, the full title then is Meditations After an Attempted Murder. So this is a story like no other. The first chapter launches you into his recollections of that day and about coming down the day before and having a very nice dinner and looking at the moonlight and about the morning strolling across and he remembers quite a lot. He remembers, you know, lying on the ground. He remembers the figure rushing at him. And he didn't realise to begin with he was being stabbed. Like, he felt something at one point and thought, he's broken my jaw. And instead of which, he was stabbed 15 times. Mm. But again, there are moments of kind of wry humour. Henry Rees who had invited him to this institution and was on stage with him, rushed the attacker, and some members of the audience came to help. But Salman was lying in his own blood, kind of wondering, was he dying? And he could hear people saying, two doctors were in the audience, were saying, you need to cut the clothes off him, we need to see the wounds. And he thinks, oh no, my nice new Ralph Lauren suit.
That's the kind of thought that was going through his head. So it would seem that at that moment in time, he certainly didn't have a full awareness of the gravity of the situation.
I think it was a mix. I think it was a mix of, he wondered, he says when he saw the guy coming, because he did think, oh, it's you, meaning the threat to life, the assassin that was promised in 1989. So I think it was a mix of things, you know. But he's still observing. He's still a writer, you know.
It is extraordinary that, well, I guess that's why he is a writer. And maybe he was recollecting all of this in tranquility. He dedicates the book to those who saved my life. This book is dedicated to the men and women who saved my life, is what he says. I guess he's talking in the immediate moment about those who rushed up onto the stage, but he's talking about others as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's brilliant in the hospital. He gets, you know, transported by helicopter to an extreme trauma ward in Pennsylvania nearby, and then 18 days there, and then back to rehab, back to another hospital in New York City. He's taken in covertly because they're still worried about a threat to life. And he's really good on the doctors and the nurses, and he's really good. I mean, I'm squeamish, I have to admit, so I'm not going into too much of that detail.
But he is quite explicit in all of the descriptions.
About the injuries and about the... But, you know, he has names for Dr. Liver and Dr. Payne and Dr. Slash, and, you know, he had a lot to come back from. But he's great on the busyness of wards as well, and the kind of ruthlessness and all the humiliations when you can't do anything for yourself. You know, he talks about catheters, that kind of thing. But there's a verve to the writing that brings you through it with him.
Ironically, that's the first couple of words in the book are that after the title page are the fact that he dedicates the book to the people who saved his life. The next page, we are other, no longer what we were before the calamity of yesterday. A quote from Samuel Beckett. Extraordinary parallels here.
Yes, because he talks in the book, he thinks a lot about the attacker, and he writes about him, or, you know, his ideas about, will I meet him, will I not? And he talks about the fact that Beckett was stabbed in January 1938 in Paris by an assailant who, it turned out, was a pimp called Prudent. Now, that's not the way the French would pronounce it, but it's spelt that way. And that Beckett had the chance to meet this assailant. The guy went to trial, and he said to him, why did you do it? And he didn't get a I don't know, sir, was the answer. But he's thinking all the way through it. Will I meet him? Will I not? This guy is arrested. 5 days later, he's giving an interview to the New York Post. Seems very bizarre to me, but they print it. And he's saying he's going to plead not guilty, which he's still pleading. That trial is due to happen this year, I think. But he's wrestling with him in his mind. He calls him the A in the book because he doesn't really want
to
honour
him. He doesn't name him at all.
He doesn't want to give him any extra fame.
Or the assassin or the attempter or whatever, yeah.
And then there's, you know, the book is brilliant. Like, it's so well written. And there's only one weak chapter of the eight, and it's where Rushdie imagines a conversation with his assailant. But it doesn't quite work on the page. He says, I want to get inside his head. And of course he can't really, and he can't go there too much to ask. So it's a kind of, Salman is talking more than the assailant. The assailant is giving stock answers. It's slightly bland. But later on he makes a speech towards the end where he writes the speech he would make to this guy. And it's at the point where the anger is dissipating. And he's saying, actually, I don't care about you anymore. I am surrounded by love and you are not, and you're not going to be. And that's the speech he deserves to write. You know,
that's interesting, because so he gets to a point where he can put that to the one side, because the structure of the book is interesting. It's in two parts, two major parts. The angel of death being the first part, and the angel of love, isn't it? I think
the
angel of life, I beg your pardon, is the second part. So obviously that there were very dark periods in the early stages. I presume that first part deals with that darkness essentially.
Oh yeah, and coming back from those injuries took a long time and a lot of therapists and a lot of... But there's a great chapter, for example, called Second Chance in the second part, where he's thinking, okay, what now? What now? And, you know, Salman Rushdie is 76 now, and he's human enough to remember everybody who ever slighted him in terms of the fatwa, and the writers like Germaine Greer, he names them in the book, who said maybe he brought it on himself, you know, and this time around the response is wholeheartedly on his side. But the second chance thing is brilliant because it's full of him thinking about the present and about Eliza and his sons and how is he going to live.
Yeah, and that's where love begins to take over. In fact, it's a huge tribute to his wife, Eliza, really, this book, isn't it, in many ways?
It is. He remembers meeting her and he tells that story very well. And I think our novelist, Colin McCann, had a lot to do with it as well. But it is a very cute moment where he remembers meeting her at an event in 2017 and he's thinking to himself, don't show off. You know, those kind of really lovely, kind of just human moments. But also, she's the one who organises the doctors. She's the one who finds the rehab place in New York. You feel her. She's 30 years younger than him. You feel her strength of character throughout. And she's another writer. She's a photographer. She's recording his responses. Mm. She's keeping him going, you know.
Are we presented in any ways with a new Salman Rushdie on the page, or is the Salman Rushdie that we've known for years?
I think it's the old Salman Rushdie. Except he'll talk about how writing, when you've 1.5 hands, his left hand was very damaged and movement has come back. So it's much better than it was. It's not perfect. He talks about he's still dealing with the eye, the loss of the left eye. It was a huge blow. So he talks about writing when your field of vision is restricted now in a way that it wasn't. But there's his wry humour. There's his self-regard. There's his learning. It's full of references to André Gide. And, you know, so it's still him on the page, but with these caveats.
So overall, what is your judgment on the book? Is it what kind of a read is it? Because I'm trying to get into my mind, what mood do I need to be in to go into something so dark in some ways, but bright in others?
Well, I think the brilliance of the prose carries you through. Mm. So I think it's a wonderful read. I think he manages, it could have been a much darker book. It could have been a much grimmer book. But it's full of the fact that he is resilient. He has survived this and he is creating a new life now, still in New York. I loved it. I have to say, I really loved it.
Yeah. So despite the squeamish bits,
Oh, absolutely. If I can read them, anyone can.
All right. Knife is the book that Paula Shields has been talking to us about. Knife, Meditations After an Attempted Murder by Salman Rushdie, which is published by Jonathan Cape. And actually, literature will be very much to the fore tomorrow night on the programme as well. Nuala O'Connor, Glenn Patterson and Lucy Caldwell will all be with us ahead of the start of the 39th Cúirt International Festival of Literature in Galway. That and television reviews will be our programme for you tomorrow evening. But that is our programme for this evening. Liam Murphy and Niall Fitzmaurice research. David Phelan was the broadcast coordinator. Paddy Carney was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme produced by Kay Sheehy.